Chapter 6. By October 1941, Jack Kennedy had enlisted in the United States Navy. Joe Jr., already trained to be a Navy pilot, had been sent abroad. On March 6, 1943, after an 8-week training course in Rhode Island, the future president, having been commissioned as a lieutenant, was assigned to take command of a patrol boat, PT-109, stationed in the South Pacific. He sailed west from San Francisco but did not arrive at his final destination, the Solomon Islands, for another month and a half. The Navy deployed PT-109 and its crew of 12 men to cut the Japanese supply lines. During the night hours of August 2, 1943, the 26-year-old Kennedy suddenly spotted a Japanese destroyer on course to ram the PT boat. Taking the helm, he attempted to swerve out of harm's way, but the destroyer was traveling so rapidly it hit the boat and cut it in half, killing two crew members. As the pieces of the boat burst into flames, the remaining men jumped into the cold waters. Thrown to the side, Jack hit his already injured back against part of the patrol boat, causing severe pain. Despite his injury, Kennedy grabbed Patrick McMahon, already severely burned on his face and hands, and leaped with him into the ocean, where other crew members clung to splintered boards blown up from the collision. Displaying exceptional skill and bravery, Kennedy directed the survivors to a tiny island miles away, saving McMahon's life by grasping a shoulder strap from McMahon's life jacket in his teeth and pulling him along. These actions marked Kennedy's courage under fire and earned him the Navy and Marine Corps Medal in addition to the Purple Heart. 6 days later, two Native Islanders found the surviving crew and went for help, delivering a message Jack had carved into a piece of coconut shell. The next day, the PT-109 crew was rescued. Jack's brother Joe was not so fortunate. He died a year later when his plane allegedly blew up on a mission before it left the English coast, and he was posthumously awarded the Navy Cross. As noted, Joe Sr. had designs for Joe Jr. to emerge into political stardom after the war with the intention that he eventually become President of the United States. Now Jack, his remaining eldest son, became the favorite to do so. After a stint working for the International News Service, owned by the Hearst Syndicate, the same service Dorothy Kilgallen rode to fame, Jack ran as a Democrat for Congress, at Joe's urging, in Massachusetts's 11th Congressional District. Winning the election at the age of 29, Jack emerged as a professional politician in 1946. Previewing Joe's interceding in the 1960 presidential election, when Jack looked like a losing candidate, the patriarch dug up dirt about his son's main opponent, which included his having committed fraud, and then agreed to back this opponent if he ran for mayor of Boston. In the book Rose, author Charles Higgum, providing a little-known insight, wrote, "Rose looked Jack over as objectively as she could. He was sickly, of course, that would be a handicap. He tended to speak too fast, he must be taught to slow down. His nasal twang would have to be modified." Higgum added another perspective on the matriarch of the family when writing, "Jack showed signs of being an intellectual. His sardonic wit and intelligence must be tamed so that he would not seem to be above the heads of the public. His father would guide him in dealing with other politicians so that he would not seem too gauche and juvenile." Jack's initial political campaign, a preview of ones ahead, became Rose and Joe's first priority with strategies galore. At campaign events, Rose would introduce her son while, as Higgum remarks, reminding the audience that her son was a naval hero who had dragged a man to safety through fiery waters with his teeth. Jack would then walk up to the platform and emphasize his hatred for communism, his need to improve housing and factory conditions in rundown Massachusetts, and his promise to bring easier taxes and better profits to the state. Young Kennedy ended up serving 3 terms in the House of Representatives before being elected to the Senate 6 years later at age 35. During this time, the new congressman, first mistaken by gatekeepers as an intern, seemed to grow with his new authority, even as his spindly physical appearance contrasted with more robust political figures. In 1950, good news became a staple for the Kennedy family. First, Rose was ecstatic when son Bobby, always having seemed a bit lost, announced he would marry Ethel Skakel, the daughter of a former railroad clerk, during the upcoming summer. Better still, the drug cortisone hit the market, providing relief for Jack's always aching back. Dorothy Kilgallen reported in her column that Bobby had been selected by Joe as Jack's campaign manager for the 1952 Senate race. This signaled the birth of an enduring political partnership between the two brothers. But, as this book chronicles, the repercussions of this partnership would have devastating consequences, resulting in three tragic collateral deaths. Since Rose and Joe had been chastised during Jack's congressional campaigns for living apart, the matriarch and the patriarch rented a Boston apartment to give the appearance they were a happy, loving couple. Jack lived close by and hired a masseur to visit his large apartment where an old-fashioned bathtub provided relief for constant back pain. Meanwhile, the family was thrilled that Bobby had joined the criminal division of the Justice Department, his first connection to government employment. Better still, Jack showed up with a beautiful woman on his arm at a Hyannisport birthday celebration for his sister Kathleen. Her name was Jacqueline Bouvier, a young journalist at the Washington Times Herald and member of a wealthy New England family. Jack had become smitten with Bouvier, even though he had, according to Rose Kennedy, been the boyfriend, perhaps too much of a boast, of Grace Kelly, an even more beautiful woman, before falling for the person who would become known to the world as Jackie. Of interest is what Grace Kelly had to say about JFK later during a 1965 oral interview for the JFK Presidential Library. She stated that she most remembered Jack's youth. He was one of my own generation, so that for the first time in my life I became deeply involved spiritually and sympathetically with the presidency, the office as well as the man. I felt personally involved. She added, "He was almost too good to be true. He was just like the all-American boy, wasn't he? Handsome, a fighter, witty, full of charm." In Rose, author Higgum described Jackie at the time as a doe in a tiger cage. Tall, towering over Rose, she had wide shoulders, a long waist, coltish long legs, and large feet. She spoke oddly. She picked her way through words with a nervous, slow drawl, as though she had just learned English phonetically. The author added, "She had gentle manners. She was subdued, shy, and ill at ease." At once, Joe Sr., ever the ramrod father, threw at Jackie a list of rules that were a must for anyone visiting the Kennedy clan. These rules included always reading the main news of the era, including, oddly, the Congressional Record, the necessity to tell at least three good jokes, and agreeing to play touch football, but never suggest any plays to her teammates while displaying raw guts during play. Surprisingly, Jackie did not disappear into the night as many women might have done. Interestingly, Rose contended, according to Higgum, that while Jackie could be a suitable mother, she was not romantically in love with Jack, but instead fond of him, amused by him, and enjoyed mothering him. Such a description of the relationship pointed to marital infidelity ahead, which is exactly what happened in spades. Nevertheless, the Star-Spangled Wedding took place on September 12, 1953, at St. Mary's Roman Catholic Church in Newport, Rhode Island, as a crowd, estimated at nearly 800, looked on. In attendance were William Randolph Hearst's mistress, actress Marion Davies, among other guests, all of whom watched Jackie stroll down the aisle toward her new husband, with brother Bobby serving as best man. A display of Kennedy power within the Catholic Church became a highlight when Pope Pius XII's benediction was read. Always on top of the news, Dorothy Kilgallen noted the celebrity wedding in her Voice of Broadway column. Later, she would avoid mentioning JFK's philandering ways despite learning of them from her Washington, D.C. sources. Their friendship may have been the reason. Of note, at the time, erstwhile actor Peter Lawford, enamored with Jack's sister Pat, entered into the Kennedy fold. He had once been a parking lot attendant in Palm Beach, Florida, where at one point he had parked Joe's Chrysler, with the patriarch giving him a quarter more than the standard tip. Little did Joe know then that Lawford would play a major role in Jack and Bobby's future romances with Marilyn Monroe and in her tragic death. Based on RFK's savvy campaign strategy, which included Jackie being front and center, Jack became a U.S. Senator in November 1952. Rose had helped by hosting Coffee with the Kennedys on a local television station. To Joe, this was the perfect stepping stone to the presidency. Ever the fixer, he made sure it was. For instance, when the Boston Globe didn't cooperate with positive news about Jack, Joe stepped in with $500,000, and presto, the newspaper editors became good soldiers. When any questions were asked about Joe's anti-Semitism, Rose barked back, listing a plethora of Jack's Jewish supporters. Jack, who had the same sexual appetite as his father Joe, promised to be faithful to young Jackie. 1 year later, she nursed him back to health after he underwent serious spinal surgery, helping to alleviate the constant back pain caused by his days in the Navy. But Jack's immune system began to weaken, scaring Rose and Joe, and for a time, doctors told the family he might not survive. But Jack, ever the bulldog, fought against his body's weaknesses and turned the corner after 2 weeks of treatment. While recuperating, Jack wrote Profiles in Courage, a volume of short biographies describing acts of bravery and integrity by 8 United States senators. It was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. In 1956, Jack was passed over for vice president when Adlai Stevenson chose Estes Kefauver as his running mate. Joe wasn't disappointed, but enthused, since he planned for Jack to take a run at the White House 4 years later. While the public could only drink in the positive aspects of Senator Kennedy, privately he displayed a disturbing bit of character, or lack thereof, that was never publicized at the time. This was the selfish side of Jack, the Joe distasteful side of him, since despite Jackie being 9 months pregnant, Jack left for Rome with brother Ted to join Joe and Rose on vacation once the Democratic National Convention was over. Rose didn't object, and off they went, oblivious to the possible complications of the pregnancy. This decision came back to bite them. After Jack had, as described by Higham, scooped up starlets and set sail on a chartered yacht for Genoa, Bobby called Rose and told her Jackie was quite ill and had miscarried. The playboy aspect of Jack's personality had won out to the detriment of the woman who loved him and had soothed his soul during his back surgery. It was a shameful act, exposing a dark side, one bordering on a narcissistic personality disorder that included a pattern of being self-centered, arrogant, showing a lack of empathy for others, the suffering Jackie, and the need to be admired, which may account for some of JFK's philandering ways. When JFK returned to Jackie and her outrage at his having left her during a time when she needed him most, the closeness between the couple took a swift turn. It may have never been the same again. One must wonder what sort of inner emotions the president must have experienced during times like this, or when he was bedding one woman after another in the future. Did he care at all for their emotional state, that they had sex with the most powerful man in the world and then were dumped into the garbage bin, never to hear from JFK again? Could he look Jackie in the eye, tell her he loved her, and then seek his next sexual conquest without any guilt whatsoever? Certainly he became a serial womanizer, behaving badly just like his father, an Achilles heel that would severely tarnish the president's legacy. Regardless, boosting Jack's image, Joe used his power and money 1 year later to get JFK appointed to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. This increased his visibility and uplifted his credentials for foreign affairs. To further improve JFK and RFK's media exposure, both shined as members of the Senate Select Committee on Improper Activities in Labor and Management, better known as the McClellan Committee. JFK served as a committee member and Bobby as chief counsel, a position that would trigger violent consequences down the road. As author Higham recalled, Bobby used his bulldog tactics in the racket's committee hearings, ones aimed at members of the underworld who would never forget his demeaning attitude and viper-like words of disdain for them, words that would fuel the animosity that would come to play a part in JFK's death just a few years later. Nevertheless, Joe was now ready to unleash his power and money to make sure his son was the next president. To that end, in the caucus room of the Senate office building on January 2, 1960, John Fitzgerald Kennedy announced his candidacy for President of the United States. He was 43 years old and would never make it to 47. With the Jack smile emanating from his very being, JFK spoke of triggering a new life to society, promising a strong uptick for a country that had grown complacent during the Eisenhower administration. With the Soviet Union taking charge of the race to the moon, Fidel Castro emerging through jungle wars to take command in Cuba, school integration failing, and worst of all, severe unemployment in America, Jack believed he was the man for the job, the man to revitalize a stagnant nation. JFK's good looks and strong personality proved decisive when he debated his rival, Richard Nixon, in the first-ever televised presidential debate. Jack's youth and charm, combined with Nixon's disastrous sweating episode and 5 o'clock shadow on national television, won the day for JFK, marking a turning point in the campaign. During this time, Dorothy Kilgallen decided to make a prediction in her Voice of Broadway column. She wrote that JFK would win since he was adorable on television. His promises and connections would get him the labor vote and the machine Democrats. Sammy Davis's support would guarantee him the Negro vote. The majority of Jews would go to the polls for him, and no true Frank Sinatra fan would dare vote for anyone else. This race for the White House, as characterized by the JFK Presidential Library, contains an obvious distortion of history, a deliberate cover-up of the truth so as to sanitize the Kennedy family's conduct in the campaign. On its website, the following summary is posted. JFK began working very long hours and traveling all around the United States on weekends. On July 13, 1960, the Democratic Party nominated him as its candidate for president. Kennedy asked Lyndon B. Johnson, a senator from Texas, to run with him as vice president. In the general election on November 8, 1960, Kennedy defeated the Republican Vice President Richard M. Nixon in a very close race. At the age of 43, Kennedy was the youngest man elected president and the first Catholic. Before his inauguration, his second child, John Jr., was born. His father liked to call him John John. End of story. But, as credible research has shown, there was much more to the story behind how John F. Kennedy was sworn in as the 35th president on January 20, 1961. First, there was the Democratic Convention, held at the Los Angeles Memorial Sports Arena. Frank Sinatra was the kingpin entertainment, but Sammy Davis Jr., Angie Dickinson, Tony Curtis, and Judy Garland also made appearances along with the Kennedy clan. JFK sealed victory on the first ballot, telling the screaming delegates, "We stand today on the edge of a new frontier, a frontier of unknown opportunities and perils, a frontier of unfulfilled hopes and threats." Previewing the famous speech he would make at his inauguration, he added that he would ask much from Americans instead of what he might offer them. As the campaign wound down, Joe realized his son would lose the election unless they won the states of West Virginia and Illinois. To get what he wanted, no matter the legality, as will be shown in more detail, Joe enlisted Kennedy family friend Frank Sinatra to convince mobster Sam Giancana and his friends to rig the election by bribery and any other means possible to win in both states. Corrupt Chicago Mayor Richard Daley did his part, and JFK became the most powerful man in the world. Substantial proof of rigging exists on several fronts, but especially through the account provided by former Justice Department prosecutor and House Select Committee on Assassinations Chief Counsel G. Robert Blakey. He confirmed that underworld figures had been active in JFK's Illinois campaign, providing financial backing and stuffing ballot boxes. Asked if the mob money made a difference in the outcome, Blakey said, "My judgment is yes." Charles Higham, in his biography of Rose Kennedy, touched on the West Virginia swindle by presenting information that was bypassed by historians favoring the Kennedy clan. Based on primary source witnesses, some of the more than 400 interviewed, Higham said that Rose was discouraged from campaigning in West Virginia because the state was anti-Catholic, a desperately poor area with mass poverty and unemployment in which the Greenbrier Hotel resembled the Palace of Versailles at the time of the French Revolution. Thus, the Kennedy Catholicism and wealth would be a detriment to gaining much-needed votes there. This was not, however, the real reason Rose never set foot in West Virginia, Higham stated. It was because Bobby invited a Las Vegas mobster to the state where he was authorized to use criminal tactics in ensuring votes, a plan originated by Giancana and approved by RFK. Regarding Rose's knowledge of this happening, Higham wrote, "She must be protected from knowing this at all costs." West Virginia, as well as Illinois, fell into the JFK Electoral College tabulation, and JFK was elected. While watching the inauguration, Marilyn Monroe must have been enamored, like everyone else, with the president's charisma, his sexual aura. Little did she know that very attraction would ultimately play a large part in her death. Just days later, on November 24th, Jackie gave birth to the child that would become known to the world as John John. Now they had children, both Caroline and John John, the blessing that Marilyn desperately wanted but would never know.